This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Roger Berry, retired veterinarian fielding.
Pat Hennigan, retired farmer.
Yeah.
And representing the Coach House Museum today.
Yeah. And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, Pat, you had some topics to discuss.
I was going to ask Roger, had he had much to do with Clydesdale horses? They appear to be very, very quiet animals. Did you find that so?
Yes, they were. They were pretty good to deal with. They were on the way out, of course, when I started in practice, but there were still a few around. And we got called to, in the early days, to cut their tails short. Otherwise, they could be a bit of a nuisance for the person driving them. And they weren't great as far as fly shots were concerned, anyway. They were pretty mostly very calm and readily treatable animals, Clydesdales.
Mm. Very powerful?
Very powerful.
Yeah, they were very powerful. As I remember seeing one pulling a truck stuck in a paddock of turnips, and this Clydesdale getting down to work and pulling it out. And showing amazing strength. Something that's imprinted on my memories.
Yes, and what about the thoroughbreds? Did you enjoy working with them too?
Yes. I got particularly involved with a stud up at Kimbolton, Jack Buchanan's, and he used to have about 100 mares there every year.
Gosh.
And he had two or three stallions. In fact, he had three at one stage. There was a lot of work involved with them. They're very, very amenable to treatments. And we used to enjoy getting them in foal and looking after the foals and foaling them. Although quite often that used to happen in the middle of the night, but it was most enjoyable.
And what about the handling the stallions when the mares were in season? Was that quite dangerous?
No, they were the stallions. I believe there are some that are a bit dangerous, but the ones I had anything to do with were well handled. And it probably depends a lot on the handler.
Oh, yes. Because old Sir Patrick Hogan, he apparently had great difficulty with, you filled me in, his famous horse. Sir Tristram, was it?
Sir Tristram, yeah.
Yeah, and apparently he was the only one that could sort of handle it.
Yeah.
Apparently a very difficult horse to handle.
Talking about Sir Tristram, when I was in America, I saw his sire, his name slipped me. Anyway, I saw his sire in America, and I reckon he was the nicest looking horse I saw over there.
Gosh.
And I came home, and Sir Tristram had just been producing his first crop, two other blokes and I had a share and a mare. We put it to Sir Tristram and then offered it for sale as a yearling and didn't really get what we had hoped to. And then all of a sudden the Sir Tristram started winning.
Yes.
And he became, you could sell any farm by Sir Tristram for good money. We were about a year too early with the one we produced.
Before they started producing.
Sir Ivor was the sire of Sir Tristram. Mm.
And what about intelligence of animals? Are you allowed to say which are more intelligent, horses, sheep, cattle, dogs? What's your opinion on something like that?
Well, they were all intelligent, I think. You know, even people talk about sheep being dumb things and dumb cattle and that, but they're not. When you live with them, you realise they're not so dumb, you know. Like, we had sheep out at Colleton when we first went out there, and you only had to rattle the catch on the gate and they'd come running, knew jolly well they're going to be shifted, you know.
Yes.
I mean, they're not that dumb, really.
No.
And of course, dogs, you can train them to do anything, really, especially those strong eyes.
Yeah, the heading dogs.
Yes. I had one that I could train to do anything, and I used to go like that and go like this, and it would jump up into my arms, you know.
Right. Hold your arms out, you know, to jump into
them. Yeah, and that shows you it was quite. And realised that I was going to catch it, you know, and not miss it.
It's very trusting.
Trusting, that's the word I was thinking of.
Yes.
Yeah. And that Gary Brennan, who was a top dog trialist.
He was New Zealand's top, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was one of New Zealand's best dog trialists. He lent me a harness and some gear to train this dog. But I never had the time, really. You've got to spend a lot of time with them. But you can train them to do anything, really.
Was it bred by Gary Brennan, your one?
Bill McLeod gave it to me. It was by one of Gary Brennan's dogs, I think. Yeah, it was related to his Dick, Harry's dog.
Famous ones, yes.
Mm.
Gosh.
So you'd use them for working with sheep, or?
We had it for working sheep. Yeah. But you've got to spend a bit of time with them, eh?
Mm. Yeah. Was Peter Boyce at Henry Rutherford's when you were talking earlier about Henry Rutherford's?
Yeah.
Peter became a good dog, man.
He did. Yes.
Yeah, very good dog.
He's until recently has been still breeding dogs.
Hunterways and dogs. Yes. Mm. Yeah, no, he did, doing pretty well in trials and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So is it a matter of training up a dog that someone else can use, or it's the relationship between the person and the dog that makes it effective?
No, generally speaking, they'll work for anybody, but they do not completely work as efficiently as they do for the owner, but they will work for others. Yeah.
Okay. Mm. A lot of those top ones, they have different whistles, you know, for going right or left or this sort of thing, so you'd have to know those identical whistles for it to work for you.
Mm. Yeah.
But a lot of it's natural ability, isn't it, particularly an eye dog.
Oh,
an eye dog is...
Yeah, that's a heading dog.
The heading dog does what? What would you use a heading dog for?
Oh, well, you put them out and they go around the sheep and bring them to you.
No, they go behind and... Okay.
They bring them towards you, yes.
Okay, and often they might even be out of sight, can't they?
A hunterway is a dog that barks and chases them up there.
So the hunterway makes a lot of noise and sends them away, and the heading dogs are quiet and bring them to.
That's right, yes.
What about animal welfare? That's often a topic in the news these days. Is it a problem that's developed or changing standards?
Well, I think there are a lot of people these days who have dogs who shouldn't have them, really. Mm. They can't afford them, and they can't afford to treat them well, and they get neglected. I think it is an increasing problem. Mm. And it doesn't happen very often on farms. Mostly farmers are pretty good with their animals, you know.
Yeah, and they'd be working dogs, so they get the interaction. And
They've got to be good to them.
What about with other animals? There's questions now about, say, the way chickens are farmed and pigs and so forth, and even with dairy cattle and you putting them on feedlots and so on. They're doing practices that were done in the past that we thought was okay, or certain, there was a change in practices and now people are not so happy with them?
I suppose in earlier years it was all about production, the best way to get the most out of your animals and as a financial end result. But I suppose they didn't really take the welfare situation as much as they should have. There are yeses and noes about all these things. There are a lot of young pigs killed because their mothers lie on them after birth. And of course, in the modern farrowing pens, they can't.
Yeah.
So there are advantages in these things. Yeah. Whether they're cruel or not, I don't know. If the animal hasn't known anything else, I don't think it's any great problem, really.
Yeah. Mm. Is some of it due to more intensive farming now, though, do you think?
Yeah, I guess so.
Because there's a trend now to free range, isn't it? You know, whether it be pigs or hens or anything, and eggs, for instance. So with the free range farrowing of pigs, do they still lie on their young and kill a few?
Well, I don't think they do. They're probably in the farrowing pens, or the sheds they've got, the shelter sheds. They probably can't, though. I don't know.
I don't know.
Haven't seen how they design them, but probably they've got them designed so they can't lie on them. Don't know, Pat.
Okay.
Yeah. But chooks, well, I don't know about chooks. They've closed down that place down Cameron's Line there. That chook farm there has been...
Has it closed?
Well, it's closed because they're not allowed to have chooks in the pens now.
The sort of cage birds and non-caged and so on.
I thought the biggest proportion of eggs now was still from caged birds, but...
Well, it probably is, but well, I know they've closed down. That one's closed down, and they've spent a lot of money. There was the whole thing was automated,
But when you started as a vet, they didn't do that. Was it all free range in those days?
It would have been all free range.
So it was all free range.
Yeah.
And then it went to more and more that you sort of factory farming, contained animals and so on. And now they're saying, no, you should be going back.
We don't buy free range eggs because they're free range eggs.
Do you buy them because they taste better and the shells are thicker?
No. I buy them quite often, but I don't. I'm on my own, so I don't have a huge family to feed with eggs. But yeah, I think that's why the caged ones are still a lot cheaper, aren't they?
Yes.
Than a free range eggs, but.
Yeah. I remember growing up just with chicken to eat, there'd be the question, do you want the light meat or the dark meat? And I talked to a chicken farmer a year or two back and said, well, now you get a frozen chicken in the supermarket and you thaw it out and you cook it, and the leg meat is just as light as the breast meat, because they've not been using the legs and developing the muscle. They just grow very quickly and grow very fast and go to market, and they haven't had that, so they don't have the same sort of taste.
Don't know.
Yeah, they're about 6 weeks now, aren't they? They've from being born to time, you know, being to on market. The table, I think.
I used to go out to Keith Bryant, who used to have a dairy sheep farm out at Alcombe, and beef prices weren't that, well, he had a lot of cattle too, beef prices weren't that flash, so his son built a chicken shed on the farm and grew chickens into poultry meat, and must have done alright out of it. Then he went to Australia and formed a company called Pro 10. And he's been expanding in Australia like nobody's business with these sheds. And they just sold the thing just recently for $46 million.
Oh, I heard it was a lot more than that.
Was it? Oh, well,
yeah,
that's
to
right.
A superannuation fund for Western Australia. Oh. But yeah, you could have got better figures. I might.
Well, there's a lot of those superannuation funds. When we were down south, there's quite a few dairy farms down there that are owned by Canadian university
yes
superannuation fund.
Yes.
It's the way a lot of investment's going now. You get the large funds, which affects patterns of investment and development.
But Pro 10 had a lot of fielding people investing money in it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I wasn't one of those ones, but I know some that are, and they've done very, very well out of it.
Well, John Signal was...
he's the kingpin, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's a fielding boy,
Pretty bright boy, John.
Must be,
Now, Roger, you said you retired in 1986.
Yes.
So that would have... It was after 84, so when we got the major economic changes, but you would have... just missed the major diversification in farming. You removed the subsidies, and then they were trying goats and emu and ostriches and deer and everything. Did you pick up on any of those changes, or how it would have affected?
Yeah, well, it did affect us. We had a lot of deer work, and it came along, you know, and. I suppose. A lot of sheep work wasn't as prominent as it used to be. So there were some differences. A lot of us hadn't had anything to do with deer, but we gradually cottoned on to that. And some of the younger fellows that in our practice were keen on deer, you know. So that was good.
What about emu and ostriches and? Goats and rabbits, they tried rabbits for a while.
I never had anything to do with ostriches, but there are some blokes around here still farming them, I think.
Yeah, out at Helcombe, isn't it?
I think there is someone out there, yeah. They were killing them at the venison plant and fielding.
Yeah, they do.
What about goats? Was that coming in there?
No, not really.
They came in with a hiss and a roar, didn't they? I can remember at one stage, you think, oh, I'm a bloody idiot. I'm the only one around that hasn't got any goats. You know, and they had, say, feral goats and trying to breed up to Angora.
Yeah.
And apparently, I believe Kevin Nesdale's got a goat's head sitting in his wool shed when they were the super duper in thing, and I think it just about ruined him. Someone said he paid $97,000 for this goat. Yeah, as a sire.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the bottom dropped out of goat farming, and
That was the problem, I think, is everybody wanted to get into it. There was high demand for goats. And then once they'd all got them, there was no market left.
Yes.
So
because
they hadn't thought of what anyone would want them for afterwards.
Yes.
The ex-mayor of Fielding, Moody, he was involved with goats.
He was too. They imported them from South Africa,
I think, yeah.
Yeah, the Boer goat.
Yeah.
It? Yes.
What about breeding patterns now? Now it's fairly sophisticated, I suppose, but there was lots of amateur breeders for different animals. You were saying, what was it, all the sheep, there was that line you were talking about, wasn't it, where all the farmers were all trying to have their own stud animals and stuff.
Oh, Cabalton Road. Yeah, Roger.
Millionaire's Mile, I used to call it.
Yeah.
Millionaire's Mile. So they were successful in what they were doing?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Romneys were very much in demand, but personally, I think a lot of that, they stuffed the Romney, you know, with the demand for wool everywhere, woolly
hair. Oh, yeah, well, there's no doubt about it. Like, there used to be the short estate at over the bridge there.
Yeah,
they had a photo in their bullshed of the champion rams a few years ago, and that's what they're trying to breed now.
Yeah, record breaker who was the top ram in the world. He won the world championship at Argentina, and you know he's a sort that you wouldn't want to get in the pen with him. He'd flatten you, a big bold clear headed thing. And they went the other way, that you know, when wool was worth quite a lot of money, put wool all over them, they were wool blind, and you're always wigging them and dagging them, wool down all their legs, and lost their mobility, didn't they? And and they've lost all that free lambing.
Yeah,
you know, like a lot of those Q&T guys used to pull the lambs out of them, you know, this ewe might lamb tonight, these are the stud ones.
Yeah.
But they'd pull the lambs out because, you know, you come out in the morning, might be just a big head sticking out at you.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and a dead lamb,
So they were breeding a bit like, was it with turkeys? They got to the stage where they couldn't just reproduce automatically or something? Just the whole body shape was...
I think French Charolais had quite a bit of trouble too, didn't they, with calving.
Yeah, sort of
two muscle bands.
That's is that beef cattle?
Yeah, beef cattle. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
I think Les Gander might have been breeding some, and he used to get the Massey vets out because I think he was tied up with Massey to help carve his Charolais at one part. Yes.
Mm.
But, I think the more they can look after themselves.
Yeah.
The better, I think, as far as sheep or anything goes. Yeah.
So with your travels, when you went seeing vet practices elsewhere, one thing they say about New Zealand is the climate's good, animals can be grazing outside all year round, and you went to various places where that's not possible, wasn't it? Like that?
Well, I went to the feedlots in Colorado. They buy cattle in there and feed them, you know, 600 in the pens. And they couldn't do that because, well, when I was there, it was snow that deep, so they wouldn't have had any, been able to feed them any other way. But
some of the big dairy farms down the South Island, they're doing a lot of indoor work, aren't they? You know, huge barns and bringing the feed into the cows rather than the cows out grazing.
Yeah, is it the Canterbury Plains or something with a density?
Yeah, I think it is part
just to cope with it.
Yeah, but they think it's more efficient, but who knows?
Well,
yeah.
Yeah. I suppose there's the issue of damage to the soil or the rivers and so on.
Yes, yeah. you know, that's a big thing now, isn't it? The pollution, and you know, the dairy farmers have to fence off all the big streams and
the riparian planting.
I was out at the farm the other day, and he'd just fenced off a dam. He built a dam actually, and it was a stream that eventually flowed into the Manawatu River. And because it's flowing into the river and taking debris into the river, and he was able to build a dam there, it's all subsidised by the Horizons.
To build the dam?
To build the dam. It's subsidised. It's called a slush dam or something.
Filter. I suppose, wouldn't it?
Oh, so all the sediment or waste coming down the river just settle in the dam rather than...
Ah.
Okay, because there is...
And it's all subsidised. It's he's got to fence it off and plant it.
Yeah.
But it's all that subsidised by the Horizons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Would that be up the Pohongana River catchment or not?
No, it was in... was it Paetua?
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Yeah. By the Manawatu River, yeah.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.